It's time for The Year That Made Me. And for our guest today, you'd have to think that the year you received the world's leading literary award for a single work of fiction, the Booker Prize, would at least make the short list of years. Indeed, it was in 2002 that Jan Martel's Life of Pi took out the Booker Prize, and it's gone on to be translated into over 50 languages, selling over 13 million copies globally, as well as being turned into a multiple Oscar-winning blockbuster of a film. But in 2026, Jan is back with his first book in a decade, a new novel, Son of Nobody. It's described as a retelling of the Trojan War from the perspective of two commoners, an ancient soldier and a modern scholar. And also as an exploration of how stories become facts and the price we pay to share them. Jan Martel's stories have certainly become hugely appreciated facts in the lives of millions of people around the world, and hopefully the price he's had to pay to share them hasn't been too great. Let's find out. Jan Martel, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you, Julian. Pleasure to be here.
Jan, where did you grow up?
I grew up all over the place. I had the luck of having peripatetic parents who initially lived in Quebec, which at the time was this deep, dark bottom of a Roman Catholic well, and they escaped that in the early 60s, first of all to study in Spain, where I was born, in Salamanca. And then my parents promptly moved to Coimbra in Portugal, and then my father got a job at the University of Alaska in the 1960s, and then to the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Then they joined the Foreign Service. We moved to Ottawa, and then we moved to Costa Rica, to France. So my childhood was lived in various countries, 10 years in France in all, in Paris, but also in San Jose, Costa Rica, and in Mexico City, with bouts in Ottawa. So I'd moved around, and then I kept on doing that as a grown-up. I got that habit of traveling. I've always loved traveling, but those are some of the countries I lived in when I was a child.
Yeah, there's a lot of big cultural shifts in your early life then. Is there something that stands out in your memory as the biggest culture shock or the biggest change that you experienced through all those moves?
Well, when you're a kid, you just take what's given to you as being sort of the norm. I remember in Costa Rica, for example, we had an enclosed garden. Over the course of our 2.5 years, we had a tortoise, we had rabbits, we had birds. Briefly, we had a monkey, we had a cat. We had any number of animals in my backyard, some wild that would come in and some domesticated, especially the rabbits. We had several rabbits. And, they joyfully came in and out of the house. So I remember that. And then, I guess the shock of moving from San Jose, Costa Rica to Paris, France couldn't be more different. But, Paris is an extraordinary city, the great city of Europe, I would say, the most stunning to visit. And I spent 4 very happy years there. And then we moved to Ottawa, Canada. Once again, totally different kind of weather, culture. So I kept on moving like that, slightly chameleon-like, having to adapt. And each one had its sort of share of, I guess, shock, but also each place had something to offer. I don't ever remember being in a place that I did not like, whether living or visiting. Every place I've been to has something to offer. After all, people wouldn't live there if it was absolutely horrible. Everything had something to give.
That also meant moving between languages as a young person. Looking back, do you think that operating in more than one language shaped you in any particular way?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I speak French with my parents, and we lived 10 years in France, as I said. But at the time, they had to send me to school, and just happened to be where we were, it was just easier to send me to school in English. So even in France, when I lived there as a child, I went to a British school. So despite the fact that I spoke French at home, and therefore, in a sense, it's my maternal tongue, the one closest to my heart, I suppose you could put it. The language I used to get an education was English. So when it came time to start writing, I just naturally wrote in English. And then we also lived, as I said, in Costa Rica and Mexico. So I also picked up Spanish along the way. So what did that do? Well, I guess, yes, it gives you a certain nimbleness. In the sense, sometimes I'm looking for an expression, I don't like it in English, and I look in French, and I say, oh, that's a good one, and how can I translate that? So it gives you a certain sensibility. But actually, the main thing I would say is, less so now, but certainly when I was a kid, each language not only had its own culture, obviously, but also had its own favorite foreign languages. So in France, I read some writers there that were not yet published or barely published in the English language. So it sometimes brought me books that I might not otherwise have read.
Fascinating. Jan, perhaps because of the frequent moving as well, you also spent some time at boarding school, which I believe you've described as a mixed blessing, which sounds like it could be a little bit euphemistic. What was boarding school like for you?
Well, it was good and it was bad. It was good in the sense that the standards were quite high. So I remember we had a very dynamic English teacher whose nickname was Bomb. And he was Tom Lawson, but his nickname was Bomb. All the teachers had nicknames. And he was occasionally quite dyspeptic, but he was also very passionate. He took the written word literature seriously. So in fact, you know, all my my teachers before those 2 years of boarding school, I still remember some of them, but overall, this boarding school, the standards were high. However, socially, it was awkward because after all, in a boarding school, you live there, which means you're chit-chat with your best friends, I suppose, but also people who were not so nice. So in my first year there, my roommate was just one of those cruel adolescent boys. We make a specialty of that. We can be exceptionally cruel. Girls too, but boys can get more physical. He was just a nasty, nasty boy, and I had the bad luck of him being my roommate. Second year was better, but it was quite intense socially. Now, I had some growing up to do, you know, so, but it was in some ways socially bruising, but as I said, stimulating academically.
You also said that travel having been such a large part of your early years was sort of a bug that you caught. Tell us about some of your early solo traveling experiences.
The first one, it must have been, I think, 19. And my parents were hosted in Madrid in Spain. And I was going to spend summer with them. And I just thought, you know what, instead of going straight to Madrid, I fly to Portugal and travel around Portugal. So I was 19 years old and I backpacked around Portugal for a few weeks. And I initially thought it'd be slightly terrifying, but it was actually just so lovely. It's a lovely country. It has a lovely history. It's a tiny little country. It had a huge empire in Africa and in Asia, in Brazil, and that has very much left its mark on Portugal. So I just remember having a wonderful time. I said, oh, wow, this is super cool. I have to do this again. And within a few years, I traveled through Turkey. I backpacked around Iran. I backpacked in South America, in Ecuador, in Peru. I eventually backpacked several times in India, several places of Europe. It was just a lovely experience to sort of experience how many different ways we can be, different cuisines, different people, ways of dressing, the kindness of foreigners who say, oh, you're a foreigner, where are you from? And that little exchange of, you know, cliches and platitudes of each other countries. Yes, Canada's cold. Yes, there's snow, you know, those kinds of things. But there's real links that could be made. And it's just a beautiful seeing the world. It really is a stunning planet. I remember the first time I went to Turkey. Istanbul's amazing, but unknown to most people, Ankara, the capital, is also a beautiful city with a lot to it. You know, Peru, Machu Picchu, all these places. You really felt like an explorer discovering these places for the first time. I just found it absolutely breathless. The excitement of being there just set my imagination on fire. And each of those places have brought me a story.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with Jan Martel, author, of course, of Life of Pi, and now in 2026, Son of Nobody. Jan, did you always know you wanted to be a writer?
Oh, gosh, not at all. As a kid, I didn't know what I wanted to do. Then at one point for a few years, I fancied myself going into politics. But in fact, the only reason I wanted to do that was the theater of politics when I was a kid. And we were living in Ottawa, and this was long before the obsession with security, the feeling of the need for it. So it was quite easy to get into the House of Parliament, to see Parliament and the House of Commons. And I remember on several occasions watch Pierre Trudeau and the opposition. And it was the theater of it that appealed to me. I realized later on that I was an artist. I had actually no interest in the minutia of public policy. No, I only became a writer in a sense because I was terrified of the working world. I remember very clearly going through university and studying philosophy, which I quite liked. It's very stimulating as an undergraduate degree. I remember thinking, what am I going to do? How am I going to earn money? And being quite terrified of that. And while waiting to figure that out, I started writing, in a sense, just to pass the time. I wrote very short stories. I wrote a few plays. They're all terrible, but I enjoyed doing it. And I guess I was lucky. I slowly got better. I had a short story published and they paid me $200, which just knocked me off my seat. I thought, God, they're paying me for something I did for absolutely nothing. And $200 is not an insubstantial sum of money. So I kept on going. Another story was published and it got me a prize and that was $10,000. And that even today is a lot of money. So I was validated early on, both by my parents and by, said I published by this small literary magazine called The Malahat View out of British Columbia. I thought, keep on doing this until it becomes clear that I should become a dentist or a pharmacist or something. But I just kept on going and I slowly got better. So it wasn't so much a choice as something I did to pass the time and it suddenly became my life. I didn't expect to do well at all. You know, the one thing that helped me actually was a movie called Reds with Warren Beatty. It's about an American journalist, John Reed, who wrote about the October Revolution. And one of his friends in the U.S. happened to be Eugene O'Neill. In the movie, he's portrayed by Jack Nicholson, a young, unbelievably charismatic Jack Nicholson. And there's a scene in that movie where Nicholson, Eugene O'Neill's in a hotel room and Diane Keaton comes in. And she, in the movie, is playing a role in one of his plays. And they have a little argument about how she's doing her role. But anyway, I happened to be reading plays by Eugene O'Neill. I'd taken a summer course in theater. And I'd never until then thought of books being written by actual people. They were just these little things made of paper that were amazing, but never linked them to a real person. And then here I see this movie with this unbelievably charismatic Jack Nicholson playing a playwright I was reading. And I suddenly said, hey, he wrote plays. Maybe I could write plays. So the first thing that I wrote were plays just because of this movie. But no, I never thought of it as being something that I could do seriously. And it just sort of happened.
And I think it's around this period, Jan, that you've chosen the year that is the year that made you. What year have you chosen for us and why?
I've chosen the year 1990, which was the year when my second story, but the most significant one, was published, a story called The Facts Behind the Helsinki Rockamadios. And it was published in a literary review. So in other words, a tiny literary magazine published by the University of Victoria called the Malahat Review. And it kind of, that was my second story. I had an earlier story published, but this one was a bigger, longer one. And it was a more complicated one to bring together. And it sort of, in my mind, it established that I could really do this. And it did well. The next year, it won me a prize called the Journey Prize. It was, you know, fame and wealth is nothing compared to the Booker, but it was still $10,000, which even now is a lot of money. And back then, and for someone who wrote something for nothing, was an astonishing sum of money, but mainly it was the validation. This was for the best short story published in Canada. And so it was hugely validating. I lived off that money for a year. I started work on my first novel, Self. And it just sort of signaled to me that, hey, maybe this is actually something you could do. That little creative flame, it's so easy for it to be snuffed out when you're young. It just takes one person to say, you have no talent. Just give it up. You know, get a job, get a life, get a job. It's at that age, it's easy for that to be snuffed out. I was lucky to be in the right environment, and that little flame was nurtured, and you know, it's endured to that day.
And what were your movements in 1990? I gather you were planning to spend some time in Israel.
Yes, I was thinking, here, I'll head out to Israel and live on a kibbutz, because it appealed to me, the idea of having my hands busy, you know, cleaning up a chicken coop, collecting eggs. I don't know what they do on a kibbutz, picking cucumbers off the field. I'm not sure what. But this idea of being, first of all, in a social milieu, you know, it's quite isolating being a writer. I'm not saying that in a negative way, but you do have to work alone. And so it was the idea of being in a place where there'd be other people and I could break out of my writing and be with people. And then while I was working and just be busy with my hands, it wouldn't deplete my mind. I thought that was a perfect idea. So I thought I'd go to a kibbutz, but instead of that, I moved in with my parents because my parents had just moved to Paris. My parents were diplomats, and they moved to this breathtakingly beautiful apartment in Paris. And I thought, well, you know, why pick cucumbers? Why clean chicken coops when you can just live with and off your parents? I mean, every artist needs a patron. You know, we can't all have Queen Elizabeth I. You know, some of us has to rely on our parents. So I quite happily lived for what I thought would be a few months, but I ended up living for 4 years with and off my parents in my early 20s in Paris, for which I have no regret. I get along with my parents. My father sadly has died since, and my mother has Alzheimer's, but I got along very well with them, and they're very proud to see me write. After all, my father himself was a poet, a published poet. He won the Governor General's Award for Poetry in French in Canada, so it's the highest literary award. So to see his son, you know, doggedly writing away and succeeding, having things published there, it was very gratifying. And obviously, being in Paris, which is a stunning city, very stimulating. And I did actually work. I don't want to convey that I was completely a leech. I did work as a security guard at the Canadian embassy. But even there, I could write because no one wants to harm Canadians particularly. No terrorist attacks against Canadian embassy, certainly not in Paris. So there were night shifts when there's literally nothing to do. And so that's also where I started writing and where I worked on this story, The Facts Behind the Helsinki Rockamadios.
Well, 1990 clearly set you off on a bigger literary journey that, of course, led to the publication of The Life of Pi in 2001. Jan, when you were creating The Life of Pi, did you have a sense that you were on to something really special that was going to resonate with audiences everywhere?
You know what? As an artist, you have to follow your muse wherever it leads you. And Life of Pi, once again, I was thinking, who's going to read this? It's about religion. And most novel readers are secular people. They don't have much tolerance for religion unless you're portraying it dripping in irony and sarcasm. And it also about zoos, and most people hate zoos because they're jails for animals. Here I'm taking on both. No one's going to read this. But once again, I was taken by this story, and I didn't expect it to do so well. Life of Pi did well enough when it was published in Canada. In fact, it was published on September 11th, 2001, the day of the clash of civilizations. And it did well enough, but I think most reviewers were slightly puzzled. They couldn't figure out what to make of it. It felt like an adventure story, but there's this philosophical religious component. It was slightly unusual. It featured animals, which is you usually find in children's stories, but it was clearly an adult novel because of the violence. So they couldn't quite place it. And it really started taking off when it was published in the United States. The Americans are wonderfully open, enthusiastic, uncynical people in some way. So when Life of Pi came out the next spring in the U.S., it did incredibly well there. People said, this is great. You know, we can't figure it out quite. It's puzzling. What's the island about? What's this about? But man, we love it. And this multi-religious character. And they just took it on. And then it did really well in the U.K. And the Booker put it over the top.
Has the phenomenal success of Life of Pi created pressures for you as a writer in future works that you've found challenging to confront?
No, I felt no pressure. Every book I've written because I just had to tell that story. And, you know, art is a gift. You give it to the world, and you can't be attached to how the gift is received. You have to let go. You hope it's well received, but if someone wants to take your gift and throw it in the garbage can, they're entitled to it. So, you know, that has never changed me. I write something hoping the world will receive it well. You know, and Beatrice Verzel, for example, has some terrible reviews in the United States. Some people don't want the Holocaust discussed in any way but in a historical realist mode. They didn't like that I was writing this obviously allegorical tale. You know, why a monkey, why a donkey? You're trivializing the Holocaust. It has some terrible reviews, but the point is not to be adulated. It's the point to enter into a dialogue with things. And I felt no pressure. What the Booker did was made me more materially comfortable, obviously. But, you know, it validated, it was comforting, but it didn't mean it made my weaknesses go away. Every writer has some weakness. And just because you win a big fat prize doesn't mean that weakness goes away. In fact, if anything, it's maybe magnified. Every book I've written has been, you know, me following my muse and telling a story that I felt impelled to tell.
Well, with that in mind, Jan, I wonder if you could tell us about the journey of following your literary muse towards producing over a decade, Son of Nobody.
Yeah, that was the result of reading Homer's The Iliad for the first time. This new translation of The Iliad by this wonderful American poet named Stephen Mitchell. It's a very lean, propulsive, dynamic translation of The Iliad. I thought it'd be this dusty, venerable, but boring classic. It isn't. It's really interesting. You can really be in conversation with Homer's Iliad. So I read it and suddenly said, oh, I can do something with this. And the result is this Son of Nobody, where this scholar discovers this lost Trojan War tradition. And there's very much this parallel between this Trojan War and his own marriage falling apart. It's very much a parallel. So I worked on that. It's been 10 years, but that's, you know, I had four children. I always take my time. I never feel pressed to produce something. I rather work on it slowly and enjoy it.
Part of the research process, I understand, involved travel. Where did you go and what impact did your travels have in shaping Son of Nobody?
Well, for this one, I went to the obvious places. I went to Western Anatolia in Turkey, where Troy is. But it's such an unimpressive archaeological site. The great, great Troy in mythology is very little on the ground. However, there's still that light, the wind, the whisperings of spirits. So I spent time there, and I also went to Corinth, to the Peloponnese in the southern Greece. There, the ruins are more impressive. Mycenae, the seat of King Agamemnon, the supreme commander of the Greek forces during the Trojan War. That's a very impressive sight. But, you know, really, the archaeology was more the air, the winds, the food, just to get a sense of the place. So then most of my research was, you know, more bookish, more scholarly, reading about the Greek Dark Ages, about the world of a Greek epic, about oral poetry, reading about the Iliad. You know, I've said it's a work of a literature, the literally the West's first book that has survived 3,000 years.
And just finally, Jan, you've traveled many places over the years. Is there anything left on your bucket list, a place that still looms in your mind as a place you would love to visit?
I've got so many. Well, first of all, I haven't been to New Zealand. I'm coming to Australia now, for which I'm delighted to do again. But I'm going to New Zealand now. It's ridiculous. I'm going to have one weekend in Auckland, but better one weekend now than never. And then I'm revisiting Australia, which I'm truly looking forward to. I'm not just trying to, you know, I'm brown nose here. It's a wonderful country to visit. You can't beat your marsupials, you know. I'm happy to meet humans, but, you know, I want to see those marsupials again. I just find them breathtaking. And then, but there's lots of places. I don't know Africa very well. My youngest son, I've traveled with each of my children. So I've been to Korea with my oldest son. I've been to Hong Kong with my daughter. My next son, we went to Thailand together. And my last one, Jasper, who's 10, he said to me a year or two ago, "Daddy, I want to go to Cameroon." And I thought, "You mean Kamloops, which is a city in British Columbia." He says, no, Cameroon. I said, "In Africa?" Yes. I said, "Well, have you even heard of Cameroon? Maybe it's a soccer reference, a football reference." But he wants to go to Cameroon. So I promised him that I want to go to Cameroon. And I'm happy to do that because I don't know sub-Saharan Africa, for example. I've never been to China. I've been to South America, but not in a long time and not thoroughly. So there's lots of places. And of course, Europe, all these places, it's like a book that can all be read more than once, and a second read will give you more. So there's still lots of places. The world is a big, big, beautiful book that with a lot of chapters, and I haven't read as many as I'd like to.
Well, Jan, it's been a delight speaking with you for The Year That Made Me. Thank you so much for joining us and for telling us in particular about 1990. We always finish The Year That Made Me with a piece of music. What have you chosen for us and why?
I've chosen Sinead O'Connor's Nothing Compares to You, which is actually a Prince song that was sort of, I guess, was under the radar until Sinead O'Connor did a magnificent rendition of it. It was a huge song in 1990. And it's Sinead O'Connor at her this sort of tortured being. It was a great rendition of this great song by Prince.
Jan Martel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Julian.
And Jan's new novel, Son of Nobody, is out in Australia now. And Jan's also coming to Australia for various literary festivals in May.